You are listening to the Punk News Podcast, episode 277. Hello and welcome to the Punk News Podcast. My name is Adam White. I'm recording for you here in my basement in Niagara Falls, Ontario. Joining me on the program this evening out of Philadelphia, Mr. John Gentile.
Good evening, you wonderful listeners.
And out of Grand Rapids, Michigan, Mr. Tom Trauma.
How's it going, fellas?
It's going pretty good.
That's good.
We are approaching the end of the year,
yeah,
fellas.
Man.
We're getting ready to wrap up. It feels like not the show or our lives or anything, but just, you know, like the year of punk news, the year of whatever we've been doing. It's been a weird year. I don't want to recap too much, but we're starting to talk about a lot of things, a lot of plans. I'm talking about what's going on for next year. Talking about, you know, what stuff we liked from this year. We're getting into everything and. I guess, John, we want to reveal a little bit of a thing that we've been talking about for a while.
Oh, indeed, I'm quite excited about this.
I want to do that right now. We'll get to the mailbag in a minute here, but we've talked for a while, jokingly on and off, about doing an episode of the Punk News Podcast that is specifically about the Clash record Sandinista, and we're actually going to do that. So we're all going to sit down. We're gonna put on our research pants. We're gonna learn some stuff that may not be immediately apparent to you about the Clash record Sandinista. We're going to debate it. We're going to debate its length and its weirdness and whether it's too much or whether it's everything that should be there. And we are generally just gonna revel in what an odd experience that record is. So we are gonna do that. We're going to record that sucker on the week of December 14th, that week. So you should be able to hear the Sandinista episode, unless we totally fuck this up, sometime on the 20th of December. So, you know, you can turn down your Christmas carols and whatever and, you know, spend an hour listening to us pretend we know what we're talking about when it comes to Clash records.
And much like a college professor, might I suggest some primer reading and listening, Adam White?
Yeah, you should probably listen to Sandinista.
Yeah, the podcast is not going to be, here's why you should listen to Sandinista. The podcast will address Sandinista as if you're already familiar with the album, so you should be at least semi-familiar with the album before going into it.
And really, even if you consider yourself familiar with Sandinista, and I consider myself fairly familiar with this record. I mean, John, I've been listening to this record forever. But I can still get, you know, lost somewhere on, like, you know, the third platter side. What is that then? Side five, right? And I'm just like, I don't know what the fuck is going on this record anymore.
I have no idea what's going on.
Yeah, so it's absolutely worth revisiting Sandinista if you have not in a while. Especially revisit the weird bits that you may have, like, skipped. Like, if you're an MP3 person, then you may do that thing that I did when I was a young MP3 person, where I had gone and curated a little Sandinista track list that was like the least insane things and the most kind of like clashy stuff on the record. But
you put like the five good songs of the 36 actually on your MP3 player.
Oh, Tom. But yeah.
I noticed your response wasn't too kind, Adam, when I told you what I thought of the album, but that's all right. We're all entitled to our opinion, right?
I believe I called you a fucking chud.
I think so too, and unless that means something totally different in Canada, that's not particularly complimentary. But that's all right.
I would particularly recommend listening to disc 3, side B, side 6 of the record, because I will be focusing on that quite a bit during our discussion.
Mm. Mm. So, So anyways, yeah, go listen to Sandinista. You should probably do that. That would be a good way to get on this. You know, there's your homework. So, John, what's in the mailbag this week?
Oh, we got some nice mail in the mailbag today. Our friend Richard from the UK wrote in again. Here's what Richard from the UK said. Hi, John, Adam, and Tom. I was at the 1982 Up Your Performance of the Addicts, probably before you and Adam were born. And then he provides a YouTube link to it. And actually, maybe we'll provide a YouTube link to this famous show.
Hold on.
He didn't think that I wasn't born, I noticed. Mm. But I guess that's all right.
do we have a date? Do we have a date for this performance?
82, he said, right?
1982.
We don't know when.
Let me see. I'll tell you in 2 seconds. The specific date is it's the Up Your Tower 1982 Blackpool Punk Festival show. So I'm sure we'd be able to figure this out. Oh, you're trying to figure out if you were born yet?
I'm trying to figure out if I was born yet.
I was in fourth grade. My parents hardly let me go to any punk shows.
I don't know the exact date of the show, Adam, but we could figure that out. And
because I could have been born then.
Fair enough. Adam White might have been born.
Mailbag closed.
I would not have predicted that the Addicts would be big in Southern California in 2015 when I saw them at Dudley JB's around the same time. At least the makeup will hide how old the singer is now. Keep up the good work. I'm off to see a more up to date band from Florida tonight called Rational Anthems. They're supporting the Murder Burgers in Derby. Keeping true from 1982, Richard, and that's our good friend Richard out there in the UK. We got an email from John. This is from John.
Addicts are cool, Richard. I saw them a couple times myself. They're excellent.
I will actually never forgive the Addicts because I went – this is years ago, probably about 10 years ago now. I went to see one of the Misfits Halloween tours, the new Misfits. But I think it was the new Misfits, not the new Misfits. It was the new Misfits, the Addicts, the UK Subs, the Dickies – and one other band, I think.
Wow.
And
like Michael Graves or Jerry Only?
I think it was Jerry Only. I'm pretty sure it was I think it was Jerry Only, Marky Ramone, and Dez. I think it was that version.
Ah, yes.
And I drove out to this place called Sayersville, New Jersey. I think it's called the Stardust Ballroom. It is in the middle of nowhere. I mean, this venue has been there for years. I don't know how. You come from Philadelphia, you come from New York, you come from D.C. It's a 2.5-hour drive or more. It's in the middle of nowhere, but they have a lot of shows there. And parking is brutal there. So anyways, I go there, it's 5 acts, and they're all playing like headlining sets. And the Addicts played for like 2 hours. And the Misfits were cut to like 25 minutes because the Addicts wanted to play for 2 hours.
Are you sure that was a cut and that wasn't just like –
No, I am, because I think like Jerry Only was kind of pissed. If anyone else there will remember this, like the Misfits then had like this big intro, but they would just run out. They literally run out. They're like, we don't have time to do an intro today. We're just going to get right to it. And they just started playing, and they blasted through about 20 songs in 25 minutes like they do. But their set was like cut in half because the Addicts wanted to play for 2 hours. Like for me, a half hour of the Addicts is enough. 2 hours was a lot.
Just want to hear "Viva La Revolution" and get out of there, right?
All their songs are. I'm not hating on them, but all their songs are kind of the same. The difference is, will they or will they not throw out confetti during this particular song? But anyways, I'm always bugged by the Addicts. This is by John. He said, "Hi fellas, I just listened to last week's episode and thought I would write in regarding the discussion of where to find new music. When I was young, I'd find new bands via the opening acts at shows. For a while, I largely stopped going to shows and would find new bands, believe it or not, via Amazon.com. When I search for a product from a band I like, Amazon suggests similar items. Tough to hear the smaller acts that way, though. The real reason that I'm writing is that a big way in which I find new bands is now punk news. Some of my recent favorites are pulled right from the podcast. So thanks to all you guys for helping me find new music that I love. On the note of new microphones, I really don't think you need them. I listen to a lot of hyper-produced NPR podcasts as well as punk news, and it has never entered my mind that your mics need a revamping. That said, if you had a link on the website, I would gladly give you $10 to show some love. If fundraising becomes a regular thing, though, it would be a major disappointment. Keep up the great work, signed John." I think Adam White can speak to this, but John, I think we are going to improve our sound quality soon, but I think we won't be doing a fundraiser because I think it's a little tacky. Is that true, Adam White?
Yeah, so after all the talk of should we do a fundraiser or not, we just went on some Black Friday sales and bought some fucking mics. So problem solved, well, at least for me. We're going to have a little bit that we need to do as far as getting these suckers tuned and, you know, getting the intransigent Mr. Gentile mic'd up on his end. But you know what? It was just something where we just needed to suck it up and just do it. So, yeah, I don't think we're going to be asking anyone for money because, you know, we all have jobs.
And this is from Phil Collins. I don't think it's the Phil Collins, but it might be.
Well, hold on. There was a Phil Collins on Trailer Park Boys. Is it that Phil Collins?
Hey, what is Trailer Park? Is that like a jack off? Is that a jack? Is that a Jackass spinoff? Is that what Trailer Park?
Oh my
is?
God!
It's like a hillbilly. Okay, it's like a hillbilly. Oh, sorry. Go ahead, Emma.
Oh, we can't even. No, I'm not even gonna. John, you disappoint me sometimes.
Well, answer my question. Is it a Jackass spinoff? Is that what Trailer
Park? No!
Oh, it's not. I thought it was. I don't know why. Anyways, this is from Phil Collins. He was on Trailer Park Boys, or he's a famous singer that was in Genesis for a while.
Or the guitar player for Def Leppard, Phil Collins.
Or the it could be – maybe it's all three. I've never seen all three in the same place at once. That's true. Hey, guys. Nice review of the Leftover Crack album on last week's podcast. I agree that each of their records is strikingly different. Constructs of the State was a worth the long wait. I got the LP in the mail and was very interested to learn from the liner notes that three of the songs are actually old, no commercial value songs. Archaic Subjugation, Corrupt Vision, and Polyamor Fiesta Crack are all credited as Stizza Alec and No Commercial Value. In case you don't know, No Commercial Value is the pre-Choking Victim band, and the listeners probably know Choking Victim is the pre-Leftover Crack band. I haven't seen this mentioned anywhere else. When I first listened to the record, I did think Corrupt Vision and Polyamor Fiesta Crack really had that old crack rock steady beat, but I did not think they were actually songs from an older era. I guess there were more leftovers after all. I'd be interested to hear more No Commercial Value if you guys know any more about them. Maybe you can do a crack rock steady episode after the Sandinista album episode. Thanks. Signed, Phil Collins.
I think Phil Collins was the guy that had the hamburger truck. I can't believe you haven't seen Trailer Park Boys. What have you been doing?
I've been what have I been doing? I've been interviewing the same two bands over and over.
Oh, so but one more thing we want to talk about here before the show starts in earnest is it is getting to top 10 list time, top 20 list time, end of year recap time. John, do you want to? You want to tell everyone what the plan is this year, and then we'll chat about it a bit?
Oh, well, as with every year, we the editors and regular contributing staff post their top 10 or top 20 albums. I think we usually do staff, then we do editors, and then after all that, we use math to compile and come up with a site-wide best of 2015 list. We're, as usual, we're also going to have a bunch of guests. We're going to have a lot of guests this year that just do their own, you know, mostly bands, but not all bands. We're going to have a lot of band guys that you guys are big fans of, you listeners. And so we really should have a dynamite end of year blowout for top 20 records, top 10 records. I don't know about you guys, but I'm pretty much got my list finalized. I'm still wrestling with a couple, number one and number two, and some of the stuff on the back end too, to tell you the truth.
No, guys, I feel good about my top 10. The bottom 20, I feel, are a little more interchangeable. I was not, you know, so what I love is, like, the classic style punk rock. And last year, a bunch of, like, legacy bands put out new albums that were really good, like, you know, Dwarves, Meat Men, 7 Seconds, like that. And there's very little of that this year.
Yeah,
and I found myself being drawn towards a lot of metal because, quite frankly, most of the punk is just too wimpy for me.
That Dwarves and Meat Men record from last year, what a return to form, both those records.
It was. They were both excellent. You know, warm my old man cold little heart. But this year, you know, there's been a couple like that, and there's a couple of great ones. My one and two are I think, kind of wrestling out really good. And, you know, but what's the – you know, last year there was one album, and it was our number one album, and it was on everybody's list.
Was that all?
Against Me? No, the Against Me record. Oh, it was literally from, you know, from a guy like me. You know, Adam and I both had it. Adam and I only had two records the same on our entire list. I was kind of looking at it, and it was Against Me and Off, Adam. We had, as a matter of fact, we even had them in the exact same spots. Hmm. But we had an 18 different albums. But, you know, everybody had Against Me. And I think I think I got a pretty good idea who's going to be on every list this year that's going to be that number one record. But, man, I think it's going to be more splintered than ever.
Tom, guess number one right now. Who do you think is going to be number one?
the Nightbirds appeal to almost everyone who's going to make a list.
I agree. I think it'll be Nightbirds.
I mean, even if they're not number one on everybody's list, I think they're going to be on every list. I mean, and what, you know, you look, Ricky and I are 20 years apart, and we both love that band. It's going to be on both our list. I don't mean to speak for Ricky, but you know what I mean? It's the one band that I think just appeals to almost every one of us who has any role in this site.
That's the right answer. I mean, I think everyone likes that Nightbirds record with good reason. Interestingly enough, and this may be a little bit contrary to how some of the music criticism works on some of the bigger magazines and stuff like that. I think everyone likes that Nightbird Records. I don't think that Nightbird Records is necessarily all that artistically interesting. And that being said, that's why a lot of the times the punk news lists, I think, look so different than what like the rest of the rock criticism universe is trying to do. Because we're all going to go like, man, Nightbirds rules because it's awesome, right? And other sites are actually creating editorial based lists where they're as a group sitting around and debating like what record should our publication crown as number one. You know, they're going to sit down and they're going to talk for a long time about, you know, about cultural impact and artistic statement and this and that, right? For us, it's like, everyone pick a list. I'm going to add them all up. We're like, hey, everyone likes Nightbirds. The number one is Nightbirds, right? So we'll pick bands like that like will genuinely appeal to everyone, and that usually ends up being the number one just because of math. And you know, is Mutiny at Muscle Beach like the grandest artistic statement of the year? Like, is it the thing that, you know, if we were, you know, really snooty rock critics, would we, you know, try to explain why it's a record for the ages? You know, no. But I kind of like that about our lists. Like, I kind of like that kind of thing comes out on punk news, where it ends up being like, you know, everyone's got their weird individual tastes on their own lists, and then we kind of have this like very mutually pleasing populist overall site list come out. So I that's definitely going to happen. I can't imagine it not being Nightbirds. I'm just looking at my own list and trying to figure out like who. Like what other band this year is going to have like that many mentions? Like Sleater-Kinney maybe? Like, I know a lot of people like that, but it's not probably a lot of people's number one at this point because that came out so early.
Rolling Stone put out their top 50, and Sleater-Kinney was the only album that I think has a chance at our top 20 to make their top 50, which I thought was sort of interesting because, let's face it, a lot of what we cover nowadays is kind of alt rock, indie rock. You know, we have a lot of the writers that are big alt rock, indie rock fans. So I don't know.
I was thinking like Sleater-Kinney, perhaps like the Titus Andronicus record is going to show up somewhere. But
people like me don't care about that. So I.
Well, yeah. So like exactly right. So like even it's hard to see what those common ones are going to be. So, you know, it's definitely going to be that. I mean, as far as my list this year, I have a list of 27 records right now that is completely unsorted, and I will have it sorted by
Sunday.
Deadline.
Sunday.
Sunday?
Sunday. Sunday.
By Sunday, when the deadline is. And in past years, and this was in past years when I had no kids and not a lot of responsibilities in life, I belabored the placement of these things. I had fucking charts and math and all kinds of things going on, spreadsheets upon spreadsheets, all sorts of stuff to justify the rationale. And this year, I'm gonna look at it and I'm gonna like drink a beer and then I'm gonna be like, fuck you, I'm gonna sort you now. Boom, 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 boom. And then it's gonna be sorted.
But the thing with this list though, the thing that I love about it, and I always sort of, or it always, my second time, give the warning of, this is what I like. You can tell me I'm stupid if you want, but I'm not arguing that this is the best record of the year. I'm telling you these were the records I liked the most. You know what? That's how I do my list. I'm not going from an artsy fartsy 10-point perspective. I might have something that I gave a 3 stars above something I gave 4 stars to. It's about what I enjoyed listening to.
I mean, that's true. Like, reviews, no one's really ever defined what a review is. Is a review supposed to be subjective, objective? The reality is, as a reviewer, generally, you kind of shoot for the middle. Not purely subjective, but not purely objective either. The list, however, is purely subjective. I think that's the only way to play it. It's what records did you personally enjoy the most? You know what I mean?
If you're making a list to prove how smart you are or how erudite your musical tastes are, you're a jerk off. Be warned.
All right, well, before we get to some news stories this week, I'm going to play a song that's going to show up on one of my lists, on my list of EPs and short form things that I liked this year. So this is a band that I have not played on this show before, although I am sure that I have mentioned, out of Toronto, called Lids, L-I-D-S. The song is called SARSFest, which if any of you happen to be Canadian, you will have remembered SARSFest. So back in like 2003, I think it was, when the SARS epidemic happened, one of the places that was really hit by it was Toronto. And while I don't think Toronto was necessarily hit by it in a way that, you know, ended up injuring or infecting really a lot of people, it really affected the city's reputation. It killed the tourism industry up here. So they had a big concert in the middle of Toronto, down in Downsview Park in Toronto, and that was dubbed SARSFest, and the Rolling Stones played it, and Rush played it, and a bunch of other acts at the time, to try to like help, I don't know, rejuvenate the city's flagging tourism industry. So anyways, this song is called SARSFest. It's from a band called Lids, from a 7-inch that came out on Telephone Explosion Records. Lids is a bit of a super group. It features it features Alex Edkins from Metz. Metz had a really good record that came out this year. It features Brian Borscht or Borsched. I can't pronounce people who have Eastern European last names. I am sorry. From the Toronto noise punk band Holy Fuck, and it features Doug McGregor from my pals in the Constantines. So this is a three-piece. It's cool and it's groovy and it's noisy and it's weird. The song is called SARSFest by Lids. We'll be right back. We're back, John. Let's talk about Pooza.
Let's talk about Pooza Fest, baby. Once again, Pooza Fest is returning for its yearly hoedown, throwdown, and showdown. This year, there's a bunch of bands playing this year, including Sick of It All, you know, Hardcore Legends, Suicide Machines. Other bands playing include Dreadnoughts, Ringworm, Fleshtones, Nightbirds, who we've been gushing about over all year, rightfully so, Full of Hell, Copyrights, Junior Battles, Penske File, Wolf Face, and a whole bunch of other bands. It's going to be May 2021 and 22 in downtown Montreal, Quebec. Adam White, are you going to hit this up? Are you a big fan of Pooza Fest? And, I mean, Pooza Fest is actually, like, really gigantic, right?
Pooza has grown and grown and grown, and it is one of, if you ask me, it is one of the few festivals out there that does at least the closest approximation of like a Fest in Gainesville group of bands, that at least in this area of the world. So it is, I think, becoming, if it is not already, one of the big kind of touchstone yearly festivals for at least the kind of music that Punk News talks about. I haven't been to Pooza in a few years. The last time I was there was wonderful. I would love to get out there. I'm not sure if I will, because I'm going to be in New Orleans like the week before that, so I'm not sure how much time I should like disappear from my family. That said, if I can make it so that I can get out to Pooza again, I will get out to Pooza. It's a great time. Montreal's a great city. There's always all sorts of really interesting stuff that shows up sort of on like the lower end of the Pooza band listings. So I'm really curious to see what that is and how that develops. And they've become really good at, you know, trickling out the big bands that are playing this thing. So you know what? Sick of It All, Suicide Machines, there's going to be way more than that. You know, especially as far as like the big names that are on here. So Pooza, you should go check it out. We have sponsored it before. I don't know if we are this year. I should email someone. That would be a good idea.
Yeah, we should, man. We should.
Oh, John, so many things require effort.
Tell me about it.
So, John, this is we're gonna try to suss out a problem that you seem to have here.
I do have a problem.
you do. So, Turbo Negro, Scandinavian death punk band, have gone and released a new song. It is called Hot for Nietzsche. It is, you can check out a video for it that is out on, that we have up on Punk News right now. This is the first song that follows up 2002's, what was the name of that new record? Sexual Harassment. Now, Sexual Harassment was the band's first full length with their new vocalist, the Duke of Nothing. So this is presumably also featuring the Duke of Nothing on vocals. It definitely has a little bit, to me, like a little bit of a cleaner sound than Sexual Harassment did. But yeah, so this is a new Turbo Negro song. We'll talk a little bit about the culture of Turbo Negro in a minute, but like, did you guys check this out? Like, Tom, did you spin this one?
I usually like these guys. I was just okay with this song. It didn't really do a whole lot for me. I believe it's a Van Halen reference. I kind of like that. Hot for Teacher. Remember Hot for Teacher?
John, you do not understand Turbo Negro, do you?
I don't. a lot of musicians that I highly respect love Turbo Negro or Turbo Negro, and I don't understand it. Like, I don't understand them at all. Like, why do they wear like sailor caps? Like, are they supposed to be in the Navy? Why do they have like grease paint all over their faces? Why do they carry sickles? Like, why are their fans like bikers or pseudo bikers?
They have like chapters all over like the country, different chapters of their fan.
The Turbo Jugend. I was just looking up
Jugend Detroit, Turbo Jugend LA. Yeah, they're all over.
There's a guy who plays in the played in the Snips, which was a band from Welland, Ontario that I will see at shows from time to time, and he's a great guy. He runs a cool t-shirt and kind of gear printing company up here right now, and I always see him in like a Turbo Jugend Rose City shirt, and Rose City is the nickname for Welland, Ontario, and. By shirt, I mean, you know, denim jacket. Every time I see this, like, on the one hand, like, I desperately want it, and I want to like can I become one of the Rose City Turbo Jugend? But I don't live in Welland. I live like you know, like 20 minutes outside of it. So like, I don't know if they'll accept me or, you know, do I form my own?
I don't think you're rock and roll enough, Adam. I think you need to eat, drink, and sleep rock and roll and possibly wear a leather vest with no shirt underneath it to be a part of that.
I feel like I should do it. I mean, like, so John.
It's sort of like bikers without motorcycles.
I'm shocked that you're not a Turbo Negro person, John, only because they tick off so many of the boxes of things that you like. Like, they've got the whimsy thing. They're weird for the sake of weird at times. They play with all these influences from like 70s glam rock. They have so many things that seem to line up and tick off like John Gentile boxes to me that the fact that you're not quite into them is odd. I feel like you just haven't embraced it yet. Like, I feel like you need to go back and you need to spin like Apocalypse Dudes. And you need to spin Ass Cobra, you know, go through those two records. You know, like shit, like your buddy Jello called Ass Cobra one of the best punk records of the 90s in some article at one point. Like, you can do it. You can get into it. I mean, myself, I'm not going to like claim that I'm, you know, some sort of Turbo Negro master here. I mean, I definitely fell off with them after 2003's Scandinavian Leather. And I don't really know why at this point. I'm looking at their discography, and they had, you know, two more records that came out after that that featured Hank von Helvet, their singer from those times, which have been Party Animals in 05, Retox in 07. And I don't know why I didn't check those out. I was somewhere else in my life. So in like researching for this podcast tonight, all of a sudden I'm really excited that I want to go back and listen to all these Turbo Negro records that I didn't listen to at the time. And I spun Sexual Harassment, the first one with Duke of Nothing, before the show. And I'm down with it. I'm down. He's, you know, he's definitely not Hank. He has, I think, a little bit more of a sort of like straightforward, kind of hardcore punky kind of voice to him, and a little bit less glam than Hank brought into it. But hey, I'm still cool with that. This new song, it seems a little clean to me. So, you know, but hey, I'm down for more. I feel like I'm rejuvenated on this, John. I want to get back on and endear myself with the Triple Jugend here. So
I'll check them out. But like, is there a reason why they dress like sailors and have grease paint on their face? Like, is there a reason for any of it?
It's just rock and roll, dude.
There's been interviews I've seen before with them where like a lot of the things that are all of a sudden like they would come up with and introduce as part of their overall look or their overall thing was very much a, you know, hey, you know, crazy rock bands from the past have done this. We should do this. Like, the whole fact that they have this network of fan clubs was very much a like, hey, Kiss had the Kiss Army. We should have a Navy. that's how they came up with that. So yeah, you know, at one point they made some sort of grand declaration that, you know, like leather was out and denim was in, and then they all did denim. And just they make decisions that to me feel very in line with the John Gentile.
I'll have to check. I guess what it is once you're into it, like, all the references and jokes make sense. But if you don't know about it, it's just weirdness. I'll have to check out the classic records.
They are absolutely self-referential in that sort of way.
I'll have to check them out. The
non-English speaking European bands always have sort of a weird aesthetic. Like, they don't entirely get like our sensibility, so there's always something a lot of times kind of wonderful about the sort of what gets lost in translation. I think there might be a little of that going on here, but if you're gonna sing a song about Nietzsche, it needs to be a little edgier, guys. Crank it up a little bit.
Do you think the Turbo Jugends ever get in trouble with like actual bikers, because they like Turbo Jugends wear biker gear, and like real bikers are not down with non-bikers wearing biker gear? At least
I would imagine that somewhere they do, because not only do they wear not a lot of biker gear, but like Turbonegro Records, at least like the ones that I'm super familiar with, are incredibly homoerotic. Like to the point they're homoerotic to the point where
it's not even erotic anymore.
Yeah. Where it's you can listen to like three or four incredibly homoerotic Turbo Neighbor songs in a row, and then you want to be like, guys, you need a new topic.
Like, they're pretty much like a hard rock.
This cannot get more gay than this already is. So I got to imagine that like if you are a, you know, if you're a big tough guy biker, not only do these guys are walking around sort of approximating your look, but they're approximating your look in a way that's kind of gay.
Yeah, it's like the Village People almost. It's like
The Village People, or between a biker and like Freddie Mercury at his most flamboyant, like where he wore all the leather pants and the sparkly red, you know, like that.
Well, I'll have to check this band out. I will give this band.
This song is not. I don't think this song is all that great, John.
This song is not all that great. I don't want to like use the band's whole legacy to make this song sound amazing. I mean, it's a little bit underwhelming. But,
start at the beginning.
Now, is there a Philadelphia Turbo?
Next time I'm on the podcast, God, I joined your Philadelphia Turbo Union.
Yeah, like I
know there's a Detroit chapter.
Here we go. Oh, there's articles about the Philadelphia Turbo Jugend. John, this is a whole thing.
There's actual bikers in Philadelphia. You know what I mean? Like Philadelphia's one of the biggest cities for bikers outside of San Francisco, I think. And like Texas.
You know, maybe you shouldn't do this by joining a chapter. Maybe you should just like listen to some songs on YouTube. That might be the baby step.
You might get your ass kicked if you show up in your leather vest on the first day.
John, speaking of cults.
Speaking of, you know, Wu-Tang is literally a cult. You know that, Adam, right? Like, there's literally a cult.
That was my seg.
Yeah, well, listen to this, people. Speaking of weird cultish bands, Wu-Tang Clan have released, they've released a record. The kicker is the record, there's only one copy of it, and that they actually recorded it about 2 years ago, I think, and they... Wu-Tang said they would not sell it except for unless they received millions of dollars, and the record would not receive a widespread release for 88 years. The only thing known about the record is that there was one copy made and that Cher was on it. Well, apparently, auction house Paddle 8 has said that they have officially sold the Wu-Tang record. The record's called Once Upon a Time in Shaolin. And all we know about the buyer is that he's American and he paid, quote, millions for it. Noticeably, the auction house did not say millions of American dollars. Now, maybe that's just me reading too much into something, but in this situation, I think we're solid that we're being skeptical. I think it's proper to be skeptical in this situation. So the question is, this is interesting for several reasons. It's interesting because it's a Wu-Tang album that only one person will hear. It's also interesting because it's the most expensive sale for a record ever. The second most expensive sale for a record was Elvis Presley's My Happiness Acetate, which Jack White bought for only $300,000.
Because of course Jack White bought it.
Hey man, if anybody's got to do it, I'm glad Jack White's doing it. Jack White sees himself as a curator and preserver and archaeologist of American rock and roll, and I support that, Adam. I support that.
I support it, but like, I don't know. I'll leave it alone.
Who would you rather have bought in that? Mark Zuckerberg?
I feel that sometimes Jack White just becomes part of a story, and it does not need to be about him, but he shows up, and I have nothing particularly against him. Don't get me wrong. It just... I don't know.
It's like Bono syndrome or Dave Grohl syndrome.
Yes, it is approaching, yes, Bono and Dave Grohl levels of ubiquity. Where like,
yeah, it's like, here's a documentary about Minor Threat. Dave Grohl narrates. It's like, what does Dave Grohl have to do with Minor Threat? You know. Anyways, I think it's the question is, would you guys ever spend $1 million for a record if you had the chance? Do you guys think this is real? C, do you think the record is terrible? The answer is it is almost definitely terrible. Even I'm a pretty big Wu-Tang fan. I'm sure this record is terrible. D, do you guys think this is just like a PR stunt? Or D, E, is – I think it was it RZA who produced this? Or yeah, I think RZA produced this. Is RZA just insane? Is that what this is? Or number six, is this the state of music now that bands can't make any money whatsoever? The only way artists can manufacture music is by selling to one extremely wealthy investor or buyer.
You switched from letters to numbers.
From E to number six. Yeah, I was going to say, I got a problem with this. But what my question is, was Cher really on it, or did they just like steal a sample? Did Cher show up and record this like one song so it could be on one album, one copy of an album?
Well, we'll never know unless we live 88 more years, which maybe we will.
All right, hold on. I'm going to try to answer all these questions.
I will never know, even if I do live 88 more years, because I honestly couldn't care less.
So let's see here. No, I wouldn't pay $1 million for a record. So that's A. Is this terrible? I bet you it isn't.
Last few Wu-Tang albums were pretty bad, Adam.
No, but you know it's here's why. Here's what I'm thinking here. It may not be necessarily terrible, is what I'm thinking. I'm not saying it's the greatest thing ever either. Is RZA crazy? Yeah, but like in a good way for these kind of purposes. Is this a publicity stunt? Yes. What I think may be the case here is the stuff that they recorded and put on this, like, and put on this individual record. It's not necessarily. I think a lot of people have been thinking about this maybe in more of like a rock band point of view, where like why would you record 10 songs that no one's ever going to hear and then throw them away? Where that's not necessarily the way that a group like this works. I mean, like, there could be versions of songs that are on there. There's going to be stuff that's going to end up, you know, like remixed and released in some other fashion under some other side project's name at some point. There's going to be stuff that might end up on a mixtape in this way or that way. The stuff that they plowed into this record, I don't think is necessarily, you know, something that is wholly unique and then to be never heard by anyone else. It's different than if, just because this is like a hip hop group that puts together stuff like that, it's different than if, you know, the Menzingers went and recorded 10 songs, right? Because those are songs that are like each kind of like a unique thing that like was never meant to be reprocessed. So, you know, I could absolutely see them recording, you know, going into the studio, recording 10 tracks, releasing them in this form as this record, and then, you know what, that may amount to demos, really, and then they're going to, you know, remake those songs at some point and, you know, use them some other way. That's what I'm thinking. I'm thinking that this is a band.
How pissed would you be if you spent the millions and then that's the case, Adam? I'd be pretty pissed.
Who do you think's buying this? Is this just some rich kid? Is this some investor? Who would spend $1 million for a Wu-Tang record? Like I can understand, like if Bill Gates was like, I'm going to spend $1 million on a bottle of wine, I would believe that. But for some reason, I don't believe anybody that has $1 million would spend that on a Wu-Tang record because, well.
All right. So is there any condition if I buy the Wu-Tang record about what I can do with it?
Yes. You may not release it.
Okay, fine. Can I make a booth and you got to pay $50 and you can come into the booth and you can listen to the record?
I believe the answer is no, honestly. I believe no public performance, no anything. Only private use only.
I'm pretty sure I can monetize that sucker somehow. John, you're the lawyer. Get the contract. I bet you I could find out a way around it.
I honestly don't believe there actually is a buyer. Like, I think this is all PR. You know what
Absolutely.
I mean?
Absolutely. Publicity stunt. Absolutely.
That's the amazing thing, is like this, the band could have went into the studio, banged out a 10-song demo, turned to each other and went like, you know, this didn't really work out the way that we wanted. And instead of throwing it in the trash, they have made this huge thing that everyone's talking about.
That's true. And also, I would point out that Wu-Tang isn't even really – Wu-Tang was never really a group. Wu-Tang is really a collection of people with RZA being the central guy. And so really what this is, a RZA album – and he probably had scraps of material from some of the guys lying around. Maybe he had some guys come in and do some new stuff. But if you actually heard it, I don't think it would sound like a Wu-Tang album of just the Wu-Tang guys doing Wu-Tang stuff. I think it's probably weird beats with some vocals layered on top. Like that's what I think what it is.
Did you see the rumor floating around the internet about who bought it?
No, who were they saying?
Well, they said it was Quentin Tarantino. You didn't see that? I don't know, and I can't.
Sounds like
a
rumor to me. I think.
Yeah. Oh, absolutely.
Not a bad rumor though.
Yeah.
But I can't confirm. I don't remember where I read it. I've been sitting here looking at the Turbo Jugen Motor City Mad Men. There's 63 of them, and they have the greatest names ever. Anyway, sorry. I'm thinking about joining. Well, I'm 3-hour drive away.
That's a pretty good guess. I mean, like RZA did the Kill Bill soundtrack. I'm pretty sure he's doing the. Was he involved in the Hateful Eight soundtrack?
He did do the Man with the Iron Fist soundtrack, which actually is an excellent compilation of Wu-Tang and Wu-Tang related guys. If you like Wu-Tang, get the Man with the Iron Fist soundtrack. Oh wait, but that's not a Quentin Tarantino project, is it?
No. Hateful Eight. Is RZA involved in that?
It's not out yet. I don't know.
Adam White, do you have a favorite Wu-Tang member?
I don't really.
I like Ghostface. I like ODB, and I like Raekwon the best.
This is one of these bands that, like, as soon as like in-depth knowledge of it starts to come in, I'm going to back off because, like, you know, in the same way that you don't want to go join the Philadelphia Turbo Jugend right away, I don't want to get involved in too deep of a Wu-Tang discussion with anyone because
you want to join the Five Nation or whatever. Listen, Adam White, Tom Trombe, you're both multi-billionaires. What's the most you would ever spend for a record?
Boy, I don't know.
I don't know if I became a multi-billionaire if I would like lose sight of what I think things are actually worth. So the answer is probably like, yeah, like the answer probably doesn't have more than like two zeros on it.
There's a lot. Yeah. I've passed up a lot of couple $100 rare 7 inches. I just, you know, I had to be a little more practical of a collector. If I had billions, yeah, I'd probably buy them all. I don't, except for Wu-Tang, because then, I wouldn't buy Wu-Tang out of the dollar bin, quite frankly, but that's just me.
But is that like King Tantalus? I've been thinking about this a lot, not to drag this conversation. If I had billions of dollars and could buy any record I want anytime I want it, isn't that kind of like not fun record collecting wise? Record collecting wise, the hunt is kind of half the fun. If you can just say, I want this one, this one, this one, this one, all of a sudden it's not quite as exciting, you know?
No, and that's absolutely it. And I think that like part of the fun on this to me is – like, so I have a list of records that I want that are on my, that are in my Discogs profile, right? So, and Discogs emails me all the time where they're like, you know, hey, you said you wanted this record from The Long Winters. You know, here it is from like Norway for $43. And I'm like, I don't want to pay $43 for that record. I want to pay like under $20 for that record, to tell you the truth. And I don't really want to have it shipped from Norway. And if money was no object and I would just be like, fine, whatever, here's $60, ship me that fucker from Norway, then I could just go buy all the things that I want like in an evening. And that doesn't seem very fun. That just seems like now I'm just filling out forms.
It's like that mixture. It's like that mixture of joy and sadness you feel when you see that some great label is reissuing some classic record that you've been like trying to hunt down for years, and you're like, oh shit, now I can just get it for like $18. And I've been digging through bins for 10 years looking for this thing, you know. So you're happy that you're going to get a nice copy of it, but you're also kind of like, eh, you know.
For me, it's when it's like, oh, I've got this rare record and no one else has it.
And they reissue it.
You go online, like, we're reissuing the record, $9.99 like,
with bonus tracks.
Tom Trombe, spin a tune. What do you got?
Let's do a band from Detroit that I like quite a bit. They are called Bad Assets. They play like a kind of a traditional style of punk and oi. And let's do a song called Motor City Violence. And this has guest vocals from Jay Navarro, the singer of Suicide Machines, who we mentioned earlier, and Break Anchor and Hellmouth. This is on, once again, one of my favorite Michigan labels, which is called East Grand Record Company. This is Bad Assets, Motor City Violence.
Show won't save any help or relief. is unsafe. Gotta watch your back and keep your gun in your waist. Motor City violence for you and me. Suburban crime, bitches get paid. Motor City violence for you and me. Just drive us a mile and you'll fucking see. Fucking see. Drugs and violence are okay for the hood, but if it spreads to the suburbs, Sully, it's no good. They'll bring law and order to protect the wealth, but in a modern city, it's every man for himself. Modern city violence. Modern city violence. Modern city violence. Modern city violence.
And that was Bad Assets with Motor City Violence. And we're going to talk about a few more stories that happened this past week. So this is a story about baseball, guys. And if anyone has read Punk News, you know, ever, you know what band we're going to talk about, because it is like the only baseball related stories that we ever bring up. And that is that Scott Rudinsky of Pulley and 10 Foot Pole has been hired by the Angels, the Los Angeles Angels baseball team, to work as a bullpen coach. Previously, Rudinsky was working with the Dodgers. Scott, outside of being a punk rocker, for the longest time, he was a pitcher, and he was I don't know if he was a great pitcher, but he was good enough to be, you know, involved in Major League Baseball for a long time. So that's really the long and short of the story, is that, hey, Scott Rudinsky's, you know, moving up in the baseball world. So 10 Foot Pole's last album was a 2004 record called Subliminal Messages. Pulley last released a 7-inch in 2011 called The Long and the Short of It. I know a lot of people are big nostalgic fans of Pulley, of 10 Foot Pole. All I know, John, is that back in like 2007, when I was in high school,
2007.
What the fuck? No, 1997. There we go. When I was in high school, I crashed my car into another car because I wasn't watching what I was doing. And in my CD player at the time was the record Unleashed by 10 Foot Pole, which I had borrowed from someone. And I was just like, I'd never listened to it before, and I'm like, I'm gonna put in this record and see what this 10 Foot Pole band is about. And then I crashed my car like right in front of my high school. And that's ever since then I've been like, fuck this band, man. So that's my story. That's all I got. Tom, 10 Foot Pole fan?
Not particularly. I mean, I don't hate them or anything. They're Pulley. I don't really have anything against them. They're just okay. But I hate it when guys are too good at things, you know? Like, this guy's a good musician, and he also has to be a good athlete. You know, screw this guy. Most of us aren't good at anything. This guy's good at two things. I don't like him.
I bet he doesn't see it that way, though. Like he's the bullpen pitcher, not the star. Awesome. And I mean, Pulley, you know, Pulley's a respected band, but Pulley's not Black Flag. Pulley's not Circle, you know.
Listen, he's making a living. I'm happy for him. It's fine. It's cool. I'm a baseball fan myself, so. Not the – what team is he playing for? Angels. Not the Angels. Screw the Angels. But anyway.
So, yeah. There you go. Baseball, everyone.
Yay, sports.
Sports. And now the second thing that I'm really an expert in is American politics. So a host of punk rockers and other musicians have signed up on a website here that is endorsing a U.S. presidential candidate, Bernie Sanders. According to a post on Sanders' website, hundreds of artists have signed this thing that says, "We, the undersigned artists, musicians, and cultural leaders of America, are excited to endorse a new vision of our country. And following that, there's a list of musicians and artists and actors and whatever else is that support Sanders, including from our universe here, Mr. Jello Biafra, Wayne Kramer, the MC5, Thurston Moore, Sonic Youth. You got Killer Mike. You got Mike Watt. You got Lou Barlow. You got that some folks from the Red Hot Chili Peppers, I guess. So anyways, there's a whole list. You can go and find it on the BernieSanders.com website if you are so inclined. John.
Adam.
This is an insanely popular story.
It is literally, going off Facebook, this is literally our most popular story on Facebook ever, of all time, ever.
Is this because people like to argue about politics, or is this because that among kind of the freaks and geeks of the world that happen to listen to punk rock and therefore follow punk news on Facebook, Bernie Sanders is a popular guy?
The excellent question, Adam. One of the main reasons why this was a very hot article is because right now it's a fairly tumultuous time in America. And I don't know if it's a tumultuous time in America because of the way things are or because of the way communication has changed. I think it's probably a combination of both. What's interesting about this specifically is that when you go on social media and stuff, your vision or your understanding of mass people's opinion is highly distorted. On my Facebook feed, Donald Trump is the worst guy in the world. Everyone hates him, but Bernie Sanders is the best guy ever. Everybody loves him. But if I go, down the street, depending on where I go, like, I've got family, not direct family members, but I've got extended family members that think Donald Trump is the great, great guy, the savior of America, and they don't even know who Bernie Sanders is. People in my office who are educated people don't know who Bernie Sanders is. And I'm not saying they're anti-Bernie Sanders, they just don't know who he is. Things are very hot in America right now, and I think punk rock, I think most people have a distorted perception of what everyone else thinks, mainly due to Facebook, to tell you the truth, and due to Twitter. Why was this article so popular? Because what's interesting is I'll put an article about Jello Biafra, we will literally get 0.1% of the readership that this article got, even though this article was Jello Biafra likes Bernie Sanders. And right now, Bernie Sanders is kind of a hot button issue, especially with young people, especially with, I guess what you would say, more hip people. Part of that is because of Killer Mike supporting him. And so I'll be very interested to see how this plays out when it actually comes to election time. Do I think Bernie Sanders will get the Democrat nomination? I don't think so, to tell you the truth. I think he's too radical for the Democratic Party, and I think that's why Jello likes him, because he is kind of a pretty radical guy, and he does seem to believe what he says. He doesn't seem to do a whole lot of negotiation or wiffle waffling, if you will. But I think like anything, this is just a hot button issue that'll fade out as quickly as it rose up, like a lot of things on Facebook. And but we'll see. What else can I say? I guess what was interesting about this, though, is on the Facebook feed, I saw lots of people arguing, say, leave the politics to the politicians, leave the music to the musicians, saying essentially Jello Biafra, Thurston Moore, Killer Mike shouldn't talk about politics, which blew my mind, because isn't the ability to speak one's mind and express a political opinion one of the core tenets of punk rock? I just don't know how certain people can make the distinction that punk rock guys should not talk about politics. I don't know how anyone could logically make that statement, but people do.
That's a weird opinion to me, especially in punk rock, that people shouldn't have that. I mean, you could absolutely maybe make that argument if you're talking about, an artist in an art form that is, I guess, unopinionated at its core. Like, figure skating, sure, but do I care about what the? It's not even do I care, but like, does it benefit the art of like Yo-Yo Ma for him to express a political opinion one way or another? Like, is it part of his artistic statement, or is it just him using his soapbox? Well, in his case, it would just be him using his fame as a soapbox. But like for someone like Jell-O, like the politics and the opinions are kind of entwined with his whole his artistic output. So, you know,
yeah, for Jell-O. Him, but yeah. What about Anthony Kiedis? The Red Hot Chili Peppers are hardly known for their hardline stance on political matters.
Ah, but if I may counter Tom Trauma, I am not a Red Hot Chili Peppers fan. I think they have a couple of good songs, but I think they're a fairly weak band. The earliest version of Red Hot Chili Peppers were firmly rooted in the LA punk rock scene. Let us not forget that.
You're right, but their songs were, even then, their songs were not political.
Touche.
But my thought on this whole thing is, you know, I have a lot of respect for Jell-O. I'm sure we don't agree on a lot of things, but I just think it's foolish for these guys to attach their name to any candidate, because ultimately this guy is going to, I'm sorry, he's going to turn out to be a bum. I like Bernie Sanders. I see the appeal of him to a certain extent, but they're all terrible, including Bernie Sanders. And he might be the best of the bunch, but I would never attach my name to any of these jokers. And I don't think they should either. I think ultimately they may end up looking foolish when Bernie Sanders does something that, you know, blows Jell-O's mind. I don't know. I think it's dumb. I mean, they're certainly, you know, a guy like Jell-O, he's always been political, and he's certainly able to, you know, give his political opinions. But I don't think Bernie's going to do any more for him than Obama did when everybody attached their name to him, and he, you know, kept many of the worst policies of the guy before him and added some new bad ones. So, well, fair, I don't know.
But Jell-O, if you'll notice, Jell-O always roots for the guy that loses. So Jell-O has never had to backtrack.
Don't blame me. I voted for Kudos or Kang, yeah, or Kudos or whatever
it was. He was a big supporter of Ralph Nader previously, and Ralph Nader never really won any presidential bid. He won other stuff. But so Jell-O never roots for the guy that actually wins, so he never has to backtrack on what he
said. I don't know if Jell-O came out for Obama or not. He did not.
He was anti from the beginning.
I'll give Jell-O credit for this, because he's one of the few people from the left who has really taken Obama to task for some of this stuff. Because what tends to happen is when your guy's in power, you just kind of shut up and eat whatever you don't like, whether you tend to be on the left or right. And you're right. I watch his, he has these little backcasts he does, and you're right. He takes Obama to task. So, you know, good for you, Jell-O, but I'm sure Bernie will let you down too, man.
Well, there you have it.
So anyways, that's a thing. You can go look at it. You know, definitely, and maybe keep this in mind, is that like this was a stunt that was, you know, commissioned and paid for by the Sanders campaign. So it's not like each of these artists individually came out on their own and made a statement about it. Like, they just all signed up to have their names on a website that Bernie Sanders made and paid for. So, you know, take that, you know, as I guess something to think about. Tom, you want to tell us a little bit about one of John's buddies here, Mr. David Johansen?
Yes, I do. So, David Johansen is going to appear in the new Bill Murray Christmas special. David Johansen, of course, from the New York Dolls, one of John Gentile's favorites.
Indeed.
The special debuts on December 4th on Netflix, and David Johansen appears to be playing the part of a bartender. Johansen previously appeared on the older Bill Murray Christmas feature Scrooged, which I saw when it came out, and that was a heck of a long time ago. You can see Johansen. Anyway, it could be interesting, huh, guys? Were you excited about this, John?
I actually am. I like Bill Murray. I'm a big Bill Murray fan. I'm not a gigantic. Actually, I'm a pretty big Bill Murray fan. I wasn't going to watch this, but I might now that David Johansen is in it. If you watch the trailer, which you can find at punknews.org, there's a wonderful, like, you know, George Clooney is in this, Miley Cyrus, Bill Murray, Rashida Jones is in it, a lot of extremely famous people. 99.999% of the people watching this don't know who David Johansen is. And so there's a part where Bill Murray says, "Won't somebody sing a song?" And then David Johansen like raises his arm like, "I will." But then like he looks over, but then like Bill Murray looks over at like Miley Cyrus or somebody, like acknowledging the joke that David Johansen is one of the most famous, well, not most famous, most important singers in popular music. And he truly is. And like no one knows it, and he's standing right there. But he looks like he's in his Buster Poindexter persona. So it might actually be Buster Poindexter. I don't know. I do like quite a bit that Bill – I don't know. Maybe Bill Murray is friends with David Johansen. Maybe Bill Murray's a New York Dolls fan. Bill Murray was on Saturday Night Live right around when Saturday Night Live was getting involved in the punk scene early on. So maybe Bill Murray is a fan of New York Dolls, and that's why David Johansen is in this. I'd be curious to know how David Johansen got into this, because this is a very – high budget production. You know, I mean, this is a very expensive thing. So who's the person that said, we got to get David Johansen to play the part of the bartender, which is genius and I love it. And it will probably get me to watch this.
How did Bill Murray get to be like Hollywood's great power broker? I mean, how did he get so cool? You see his stickers of his face and tattoos. And
I'll tell you how.
I don't know.
He was in a ton of great comedies, you know, from in the 80s and the 90s. Some of the greatest comedies, you know, what was he in? He was in a Groundhog Day. He was in, I can't believe I'm blanking on all the wonderful comedies.
Caddyshack. Stripes. Ghostbusters.
He's in all these marvelous films, but during that same time,
he was Meatballs.
He was also in some really good films. There's one where he's like a clown robbing a bank. I forget the name of it. However,
Quick Change.
But instead of doing the quote sellout thing, like unfortunately, De Niro might be the greatest actor ever, but De Niro sold out and just made a bunch of shitty movies. Pacino did kind of too. Instead of doing that, Murray flipped the script and started doing a bunch of low-budget art house production. He kind of plays the same character in all of them, but at least he's doing it with integrity more or less. So when people see Bill Murray, they are remembering how funny he was in those classic films, but also how he's a solid actor and only seems to take on things that he really cares about. So people like him because he is a comedy legend, but he also seems to have a certain amount of integrity in his work, despite Garfield 1 and 2.
the best thing about that is that I don't know how you can explain Garfield 2 about this, but for the first Garfield movie, there was an interview with Murray in I don't know, like Slate or Esquire or something like that, and he claims, at least at this point, that the only reason that he signed the contract to do the first Garfield movie was because one of the writers was named Joel Cohen, and he's like, oh, I want to work with the Cohen brothers. But it like wasn't that Joel Cohen?
I think that's a Bill Murray joke, though. I don't quite believe that.
Yeah, that's like no, you didn't. Like that's yeah.
No, they backed a truck of money up to his house, and he did it.
But because he's like, Bill Murray, like you find that adorable and hilarious, and not like you asshole, you know, just because he's Bill Murray. And also, he is extremely good at PR. Remember, for a little while, he was going to like house parties in Brooklyn and like cleaning people's dishes for them and stuff.
He was crashing weddings for a while too. There was a lot of that, like people posting like are like he'd show up at someone's wedding and like do a toast and then leave, like he wasn't invited. And
he
yeah.
like doesn't have a manager. He does. I don't know. He's just yeah. He's a kind of an oddball. But
listen, it's Caddyshack, Stripes, Tootsies, Ghostbusters, Scrooge, which is not that great. Ghostbusters 2, Quick Change, What About Bob? And then after What About Bob, I think is where we have the big. Nah, my computer's locking up. Oh, come on. Oh, here we go. Groundhog Day. Then here's where it flips the script. Kingpin. Ed Wood. Rushmore. Let's see what else we got. Hamlet. Royal Tannenbaums. Lost in Translation. See, that's exactly where he went from like comedy actor to like respected actor. Broken Flowers. Garfield, A Tale of Two Kitties.
That is a black mark, man.
Oh, poor Bill Murray.
I mean, briefly, do you guys think Bill Murray said, I want David Johansen, or is that somebody else, you think?
I'm willing to bet that Bill Murray said, I want David Johansen.
That's so cool, man. That's so cool.
So one final story that we're going to talk about this week, about Shane McGowan of the Pogues. John, take it.
All right, Shane, there's going to be a documentary, but not about Shane McGowan, a documentary about Shane McGowan's teeth. The documentary is – of course, you all know the Pogues were very, very famous, very important. I guess you would say Irish influence punk or slash rock band, you know, in the UK in the 80s and even in the 90s. Shane McGowan was the lead singer, but they fired him because he was too drunk. And, of course, Shane McGowan is famously sloshed all the time. The guy was probably drunk for about 30 years straight. I think he's still drinking. The documentary – but, however, Shane McGowan was also famous for having terrible, terrible teeth. Even when he was, like, 18, he had these horrible, horrible teeth. And they just got worse and worse and worse. And up until about the 2000s, like for a while he had, like, four teeth, and they were literally black. He had four black teeth in his mouth, and they were – and like, I don't know how his mouth wasn't riddled with pain to have these black cavity-filled teeth, but he still had them. Well, there's a documentary coming out in the UK. Hopefully it'll come to America. It's going to be called Shane McGowan, A Wreck Reborn, and it will follow the tale of Shane McGowan losing his final teeth, getting dentures, refusing to wear the dentures because he doesn't like them, and then finally getting implants, including one gold tooth. there will be footage of the actual surgery itself. And so the question is here, would you guys watch this? I certainly would. But the other question is, I'm angry at Shane McGowan for throwing away his phenomenal talent. Shane McGowan is one of the greatest punk or just rock singers ever, certainly one of the most talented performers, and certainly one of the most talented lyricists. But he just couldn't put the bottle down. He destroyed his voice. He destroyed his career. And the Pogues' live performances after the initial few years were not good at all. I mean, am I allowed to take that position that says, Shane McGowan, I'm mad at you for not providing the art that you could have provided had you not had that alcohol problem? Or is that too hard not hardline, is that too unfeeling for me? Should I be saying, isn't it sad that Shane McGowan had an alcohol problem? Like, I want to shake him and say, how dare you be so selfish and rob the world of your gift just because you want to drink? Is that a cruel statement for me to make?
Would we have gotten those great albums? Would we have gotten Rum Sodomy in the Lash if he wasn't drunk, John? I don't know. I think it was so intrinsically involved with everything he's ever done that if it wasn't for the alcohol, we would have got the art. That's what I would go so far as to say.
But I think he got worse and worse. I would agree with that, actually. However, I think he got worse and worse and worse. Why couldn't he stay at the level of Rum Sodomy in the Lash?
That picture, that picture we ran with the article, it's sort of sad looking.
It is sad looking.
He's sort of sad looking.
He's got like sores all over his lips, you know?
You know, as far as the movie, I don't know. I looked up some older pictures of him, even when he was a real young man, you know, his ears are sticking out in his mouth. And I just don't know if I could look at it for an hour and a half. It's pretty grotesque. That's my
thing. It's I love those first few Pogues records and everything, but I don't want to see film footage of like, I mean, of both Shane McGowan's mouth and of anyone's dental surgery, like that. Like, I mean, if you want to make that like really super compelling, you know, filmographer, you know, it would be a huge demonstration of your skill because just the thought of that, I'm just like, ugh, I don't wanna. Like, yeah. Man, there's so many things in my Netflix queue that I want to get through before I watch Shane McGowan have dental surgery, you know? Oh, not.
And listening to him, like, be all sloshy and talking and, you know, looking old and sad. I don't know.
He's only, like, 55. He looks like he's 75.
Yeah.
Now, I'd like actually to bring – actually, this would be a good thing to bring up here because people from the UK always write us about the things that we don't understand from their end of the world. The article that we linked to for this was from
– some Irish paper.
Okay. You know, so from Ireland, not the UK.
Ireland from, in the UK?
Is, I don't mm-mm, know. Mm-mm. I'm never sure.
Scotland, England, Wales. And
no, don't go there. The second we start parsing what is or is not in,
I mean, it's
in the UK / England / the British Isles / that hemisphere, you've all offended right. someone. So all we're right. just going to say Ireland.
I'm pretty sure Ireland's an independent country, but yeah, all right.
But anyways, this was an article from the Irish Sun. So like one of the Sun papers. And it is the most obnoxiously written thing I have ever read. Like, it was just, like, every sentence in it was a stupid quip. And just trying to get through this article to actually, like, parse out the source of this story just made me angry. like, is this the way all, like, you know, all the tabloid papers from that end of the world are written? Because, God, it is a crime against, you know, the English tongue, so ugh. I'm offended.
Yeah, everything's like so snappy. You know what I mean? It's like
like the gleaming results are a stark contrast to Shane's gappy gob in 2009. Fuck off!
Was he cooperating? Was there any word on whether or not he was actively like allowing them to do this, or is it just all like? Was he participating? Did they, John? Do you remember?
Or Adam? Oh, I mean, I'm sure he signed off on the documentary. Like, I don't think like they like covertly filmed him.
No. Okay. Well, I mean, did he? I wonder if he did. Did he participate? I don't know.
The, the big-hearted trad star is also hoping that his new ivories will bring a smile to those without a roof over their heads this Christmas. Like, what the fuck? Like, oh, God.
His two remaining stumps were removed, and he had a new set of shiny white gnashers installed. But soon he stopped wearing dentures, claiming they were uncomfortable and made him look like a dickhead. The long saga is subject to a new documentary that is due to air on Sky Arts next month.
Okay, so you went from, like, bad Cockney to, like, bad Australian somehow. That
crikey! Shane McGowan's getting new dentures!
Oh, God, I'm sorry the rest of the world for our whole continent. Anyways, John, can you play a song and stop doing impressions?
Yes, to wrap it up, we talked about some of our favorite records. I'm going to play one of my favorite records of 2015, and actually it's a new record. It's by one of my favorite bands of all time. Bad Canoes, which features Marissa Paternoster of Screaming Female, Dawn Riddle, Christina Centaur, and Kate Ills. They are a fantastic synth-punk band based out of Philadelphia. This is off their brand new EP. The brand new EP is called Bad Canoes, and this track is called Radio Without Rules, mate.
When you wanna tune in, cause you need to tune out.
That was Bad Canoes. This has been your Punk News Podcast for the week of whatever week it is in early December of 2015. I'm Adam White. I've been joined by John Gentile and Mr. Tom Trauma. If anyone wants to write us any mail, it is podcast@punknews.org. That's how you get a hold of us. And I think that's all. Is that all?
Blimey. That's the rate of the rat's barrel.
Stop it. Don't write us mail about that.